This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions go head-to-head with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and, of course, on the air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. One of the big stories on the minds of Americans this week, second only at times to holiday shopping, of course, is the fiscal cliff. President Obama's not sitting down through all of this. In fact, he's actually taken to a campaigning stance, bringing his story to the people, meeting with small business owners, CEOs, and middle-class taxpayers. Friday, he's heading to Pennsylvania to a toy factory to spread the gospel up there as well. At this point, still no actual meetings with congressional leaders who he needs to get into his camp to avert the cliff. Only time will tell. And at this time is running short. A bit later in the program, we'll be talking electronic health records, but not in the same way we've done it previously. Sure, they're new, and the nation's in the process of a complete transition from paper to electric charts, but I'm talking about the benefit of electronic health records in the wake of Hurricane Sandy specifically. Power was lost, hospitals were evacuated, continuity of care remained, however, thanks to electronic health records. Healthcare analyst Suzanne Levingston will be here shortly to discuss. But first, let's go dive into a big pile of money. Come on, let's do it. It's right over here. It's going to be fun. Oh, wait. Hold on. Apparently, this money isn't for everyone. $20.5 billion via multiple award contracts for spies? Federal business analyst Brian Friel is here with more. Seriously, Brian? Spies?
You know, the intelligence agencies are a big business.
Yeah.
Most people are familiar with the unclassified spending that the government does through contracting. Bloomberg government's estimate is about $530 billion a year in unclassified spending in fiscal 2011. We estimate that there's about $50 billion in contract spending by the intelligence agencies. Most of that is not reported as part of that unclassified work. And so what we did was we attempted to identify all of the contract vehicles that we could that give companies a way into the intelligence agencies to do work ranging from technology systems development to smartphone application work to the grunt work of doing the actual analysis of maps and,
right.
and linguistics and that kind of work.
So the insight is called Spy Agency Max bring 80 companies $20 billion. And the very first sentence basically says it all. Intelligence agencies are ordering at least $20.5 billion in technology and professional services through 2017. Is that a typical amount of money looking at a five-year period, or are we above or below what traditionally they've been throwing out there via MAC?
Well, this is the first time that anyone that I know of has done a public analysis of these spy agency contracts.
That's the ringing of the BGov bell. That's the
So this is kind of the baseline.
So this is the baseline, okay.
And the $20 billion represents the combined ceiling of all 20 of the contracts that we identified across the agencies.
Right.
And it's certainly an underestimate. There's some of the contracts we couldn't identify the ceilings, and I know that there are contracts that haven't been publicly announced that also have additional money on them. But what it suggests is if you divide that $20 billion by five, you come up with about $4 billion a year in potential spending on these contracts.
Let's talk about the agencies themselves. You've identified four agencies and their locations and such. Why don't you run them down for me?
So first, the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
That is the sort of primary conglomerator of intelligence information across the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, the Navy, etc. And they are the most public about their MACs. They have the largest MAC, a $6.6 billion contract called SITE, that is for technology-type work. There's the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. This is the agency that looks at the satellite imagery and to see what's going on in hotspots around the world. And the NGA has a major recompete going on right now for its GEOINT geospatial intelligence data services contracts.
Try saying that three times real fast.
Right. And a huge amount of work, $1 billion just on one of the contracts alone. And it replaces an existing contract called Global Geospatial Intelligence, through which six companies have been competing for about $750 million. So it's a growing area of work, and more companies are likely to get a piece of it in the future. Then there's the National Reconnaissance Office. This is one of the more secretive agencies. This is the agency that is best known for launching spy satellites
supposedly
into space.
Supposedly, right. They launched.
Right. You know? people used to not even acknowledge their existence.
We don't even know. Yeah.
And they're the two MACs that I identified for them. I'm not even sure what the period performance is and everything. but one of them, a very interesting contract called Rapid Operational Multi-Int for Intelligence Omnibus, or ROMO. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if there's a Dallas Cowboys fan at the NRO naming that contract. But it's for application development, and the idea is to develop applications that all intelligence agencies can use to do analysis. So there's this common thread across a lot of these of finding ways to integrate intelligence activities across the 16 agencies that are part of the intelligence community. And just the last one was the National Security Agency, and they have publicly revealed the existence of two of their contracts. One in particular is interesting because it's with 34 small businesses. It's called the NSA Set Aside for Small Business 2 contract, $800 million ceiling, and it runs through next October, which means that a recompete will be taking place, so companies – new companies will have an opportunity to seek out a role at the NSA this year.
So let's talk about the recompete process, because there's one that's up for debate. We've got 80 companies, that is, that are currently have that hunting license, so to speak. They're on these MACs already. When they come up for recompete, I'm a new company, I've just gotten started. Where am I going to turn to go and potentially get that license so I can actually bid on these things?
A big way that companies get into the intelligence agencies, in particular through these MACs, is by first subcontracting to the primes. That's one of the reasons in our analysis we listed out the names of the prime contractors on the existing vehicles, because companies that are not in the space yet can go out and find subcontracting relationships with the primes, and then from there develop a relationship with the agencies themselves, and then become prime contractors. CACI is one company that moved into the intelligence agencies that way as a subcontractor and then as a prime. A small company called OGS in Northern Virginia did that too, and now has started out as a subcontractor and now has three prime contractor positions on these intelligence agency MACs.
Good opportunity to bring up some of those contractors that are out there looking at the Defense Intelligence Agency. There are quite a few of them, and that makes sense, being that they have the most money at this point available. Run the gamut here of some of the companies that we can find currently out there through 2017 or so.
So SAIC has the most positions on the MACs that we identified. They are on 8 of the 20 contracts that we identified. Mm-hmm. And that's consistent with our analysis in the unclassified space. SAIC holds more positions on multiple contracts than any other company, and as a consequence, generates more of its revenue through multiple contracts than any other federal contractor. Other big players are Booz Allen Hamilton, which does a lot of cybersecurity work both in the classified and unclassified world. BAE Systems has been moving really aggressively into the intelligence communities, particularly through these MACs. I mentioned CACI, Computer Sciences Corp. And then some of the rising stars, of the contracting world, such as 6-3, which is a company that was created by a private equity firm and sort of is conglomerating small businesses into a growing intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance and intelligence analysis type company, and they have won positions on some of these contracts.
Money to be had out there, definitely, with the Defense Intelligence Agency. Let's take a look at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Looks like the earliest expiring contract out there at this point, one that the Global Geospatial Intelligence Group, and you mentioned that one just a moment ago, expiring, this one, January 2013, it looks like.
That's right. So this is a big opportunity because there's a suite of contracts, both single award and multiple award, that are consolidating a lot of the geospatial analysis work that is done by the agency. So it reflects a broader trend of agencies trying to bring together a lot of their contract work into single contract programs, rather than having this contract here and that contract there and this contract here.
When we're talking about administrative services or admin serve, what are we looking at there in that space?
Well, the admin serve contract right now. It's a $102 million contract that runs through June of next year. It's being replaced by a contract called ESAS, E-S-A-S. And it's only for small businesses. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of work, like clerical work, secretarial support, office management type work. And a lot of these contracts in general, including the AdminServ, are for people to go into the intelligence agencies and staff it. And so a lot of the contracts are based on labor rates, and companies bid labor rates and then provide people that go cleared people with security clearances to go in and do work at the agencies.
That's interesting. I guess I would have assumed that they would have been agency employees, not necessarily contractors coming in and doing.
One of our analyses by my colleague Rob Levinson found that I think something like 70% of the intelligence agency budget was estimated to be contracted out. And that means that the agencies are relying really heavily on contract personnel to come in. And if you drive around Northern Virginia and you see all the big buildings with the unmarked buildings, it's not just government employees. There are a lot of contractor employees performing this work.
That's interesting. I live out in the Fort Meade area, so I'm very familiar with the unmarked buildings. And I see the big globe-like structure at NSA almost daily. Wonder what they can tell about me.
Yeah, and you know, and the work that's being done in Central Maryland around NSA and out in Northern Virginia around NGA and down around Fort Belvoir for Bowling Air Force Base, the sort of hubs of intelligence agency work. That work is not going away. You know,
it's growing. There's a lot more work being brought in that direction.
Right. The especially in the cyberspace arena, and all of these agencies participate in that work, particularly NSA. All of that work is a growth area, and so as companies are seeing flat budgets in non-defense and in defense, they can look at the intelligence agencies as a place to expand some of their business.
Looking at NSA specifically, set aside small businesses. Looks like they've got a lot of money set aside for that. And October 2013 is when more of it's going to be up for bid.
That's right, and the trend across a lot of these multiple contracts has been an increase in the use of set asides for small businesses, and you see that in a lot of these contracts where previously in previous versions of the contracts, for example, at DIA, a couple of their big contracts had six, seven, eight prime contractors, mostly large businesses in previous versions. In the newer versions, there tend to be three, four, five small businesses. And that reflects a trend in the unclassified realm. A lot of the trends that we see in the unclassified realm take place in the intelligence agencies as well. So it's a good time for small businesses to go out and try and make connections both with the prime contractors that are currently doing work in the agencies and with the agencies themselves, because they are actively looking for new small businesses to do work with.
Prime opportunity for that disgruntled employee to spin off and open up their own company come January 1 and start looking for some small business work at NSA. Is that what you're saying?
A lot of this work will not, big companies will not be able to bid on it as prime vendors. So.
Yeah. You're listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. My name is Alan Scott. We're speaking with Brian Friel. He's a federal business intelligence analyst with Bloomberg Government, who's recently written Spy Agency Max Bring 80 Companies $20 Billion of Bloomberg Government Insight, currently available on bgov.com. What kind of advice as we continue down the small business path? Because there are a lot of them, especially in this area.
Well, a key aspect of getting into this work is relationships. It's true across all business, right?
Sure.
And especially in federal contracting, but in particular at the intelligence agencies, because this work is not generally publicized. We don't have reported contract spending on this work. We can't go into detail about what is actually being performed on these contracts because that information is not released publicly. So to really understand what you can contribute to these contracts, you have to get in and talk to the people that are currently performing them and see how you can add to what they're doing, fill in gaps that they have, serve as a prime for large companies that want to continue to do work in areas that are being increased. increasingly set aside for small businesses. It's really in particular about relationships in the intelligence agencies.
It's about relationships, and we'll end it with that. Any parting thoughts?
Well, we'll be continuing to do analysis in this area and following the recompetes, and so you can be looking out for more intelligence agency analysis on Bloomberg Government.
Take a look at BGov.com for more. Brian Friel, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. And not a day goes by without some sort of imagery from Hurricane Sandy on TV, whether it be shells of homes left behind, that roller coaster out in the water on the Jersey Shore. The big one that stands out in my mind is actually those patients being wheeled out of NYU amidst the flooding in the hospital and all the chaos that was Hurricane Sandy. Certainly all hands on deck in that situation. Everyone pitched in to get everyone to a safer place, which kind of leads to my first question for my next guest. Her name is Suzanne Levingston. She's a healthcare analyst with Bloomberg Government. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well, doing well. So I simply have three words for you. Continuity of care. How was that managed?
You know, it was a Herculean effort, and it was a lot of sweat and tears, and bless them all. They did a fabulous job. What they did... I focus on health IT.
Exactly.
And we were, you know, one always wonders, okay, so the power is out. What's happening to the electronic health records they're supposed to have? Well, these savvy healthcare professionals know enough to have backup paper ready, and they printed up documents for the folks that they were transferring. So everybody who got transferred had some paper documentation heading to the next place. But the sort of, I mean, it was a terrible tragedy, but the, I don't know, interesting and kind of neat thing about it all is that it sort of showed, you know, when people came back online and were able to plug into the electronic health records, everything was still there. The records were still there. The, you know, the data was intact. The prescription drug information was intact. Mm-hmm. It's all there. And it's just, for me, kind of an exciting indication that we've really progressed pretty far in terms of adopting electronic health records.
Lessons learned from disasters previous. I mean, my son, sick for a long time. He's only 5 years old. He's got pneumonia again right now. I'll show you the pictures of him getting his x-rays at the hospital over the weekend.
Yeah.
That was fun. People look at him and go, he doesn't look sick. He doesn't look sick. But, yeah. and that's what I'm getting at.
Yes.
He doesn't look sick until you look at the size of what was his paper chart.
Right.
And you see that thing was 2-3 inches thick, and he's only 5 years old.
Yeah,
and there's two of them.
Mm.
You know, two folders containing all of the information for him.
Mm.
Looking at the previous disasters,
yes.
Katrina specifically,
yes.
In New Orleans, an elderly population, let's say,
yes.
likely gigantic charts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing a lot of that information back then, because this truly hasn't gone into place until... Of late,
yeah.
Within the past 3-4 years, as people really start making the transition.
Yeah.
How bad was it back then?
Well, it was very bad. I mean, the thing is, they're making the transition now because the government has this incentive program to help doctors pay for the health records. So there's been a spike of folks using them. But back in the days of Katrina, I mean, there were, you know, folks have done a lot of studies of this. There were, I think, 200,000 chronically ill people who were displaced. And unless you happen to have been a patient of the VA,
right.
which had electronic health records and had a system, and if you went to another VA facility, your records were there. These folks, they had no records, they had no medicine, they had no contact with their providers. I mean, it was just a healthcare nightmare. So, you know, if you look at where we are now versus then, it's remarkable. And, you know, as a health IT enthusiast, I must say that it's, you know, Yahoo for the EHRs.
I would imagine that the government has played a part in regulating this somehow.
Well, the timing was very interesting because it just so happens that come the new year, providers are probably going to have to be audited by HIPAA to make sure that the privacy and security of their systems is viable.
Right.
And when we talk, you know, when we think about health IT and you say privacy, you think, oh, well, someone is accessing your data and that's bad, and that is bad. But you also have to maintain the integrity and the availability of it, which, you know, with these power outages, that's something folks have to look into. So providers, it's not clear how these audits are going to happen, but providers have to have plans for how they're going to maintain all the issues they have to get on top of. So it was, for me, just remarkably timely that here's this giant, unprecedented, unimagined event that, you know, is dealing with the security of health IT, and come in a couple months, providers are going to have to start, you know, looking over their plans, and probably a lot of them have already been looking over their plans given what just happened. I know a lot of folks in New York are doing that.
Oh, definitely.
In New Jersey.
You know, little things like a business continuity plan, ensuring that you know what everyone is to be doing in the event of an emergency, a backup, backup to power, and in some cases a backup to your backup.
Indeed.
You know? And when your backup ends up underwater.
And having a backup, you know, an internet provider and a backup internet provider, you know, you just got to try to cover all your bases. And we've, you know, it was not imaginable, but now suddenly folks who didn't think they were below sea level are below sea level.
Surprise.
So you're going to have to, you know, make plans to make sure that stuff isn't way down in your basement anymore.
One of the big things that I know a lot of companies are looking at and have been looking at for years is ensuring that their data is in multiple places.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily one in one. Hell, I've got this one here, and right next to it, I've got another backup of my data. You want to make sure that's off-site, someplace far, far away from the devastation that you may be experiencing at their primary location.
Absolutely. That's part and parcel of the whole thing. You have to have it at another site. I mean, depending on who you are, big financial institutions have it in other countries, but definitely across town, across the country, it's the way to go. And also going into the cloud as
I'm doing the air quotes, the cloud.
The cloud.
The cloud.
You know, and it's not really a cloud. It's having your data on, you know, say a vendor system in a bunch of different places.
Sure.
It actually does exist. But that's a big business trend as well, and it's sure necessary to back up the health data.
How far along are we in this transition? I mean, we talked about the fact that the Medicare and Medicaid providers are being, there's incentives out there.
Mm-hmm.
How far along, or how far have we gotten, or can we tell at this point in the transition to those electronic health records?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the numbers keep going up. The newest figures are out this morning, and if I remember, I think they're up to have given out $8.4 billion,
wow,
which is a lot. And so they're trending upward. Dr. Mustashari, who's the National Coordinator for Health IT, you know, thinks that next year all healthcare is going to be essentially, more than half of all healthcare is going to be recorded electronically, digitally. So we're just continuing to move forward.
Yeah, slowly but surely. Yeah. So as the transition continues, I believe one of the things that was a requirement or they were looking to have implemented, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was a portal of sorts for users to be able to go in and gather their own information should they need to.
Oh, yeah. It's a patient portal.
A patient
portal,
okay.
Right, and it's actually part of the requirements that providers have to meet to get the incentive money. You know, the latest round, a certain percentage of patients have to connect with the doctor some way.
Sure.
You know, from home.
Sure.
And that's just to get folks used to the idea of it. And frankly, if the patient sort of took ownership of their electronic health records, in a sense, it's another layer of
transparency, so to speak.
And also of security, because in a sense, all right, if something happens to the double backup, if the patient were somehow connected,
good point.
You know, and there's also, you know, there's networks, state networks that are starting to spring up. There's a New York state network that was used during Hurricane Sandy. Patients who were transferred from one place to another, doctors at the next place plugged into it, and there's the health record. So
seamless continuation of care,
Continuity of care. And I mean, it's, you know, it's a kind of a giant slog for everybody to get to that point. It's a lot of work needs to be done, but the progress is certainly forward moving.
Like moving into that new house. It really sucks packing it all up. But once you've unpacked it and get it all in the places that you want it,
it's a good fit, and it works, you know?
That's for sure. Her name is Suzanne Allard Levingston. Her latest piece of work is called Electronic Health Records Survive Hurricane Sandy. And to that we say, woohoo! Suzanne, thanks a lot for being a part of the
show.
Thank
you, Alan.